At that time, there lived in the great city of Vaishali a certain Lichavi, Vimalakirti by name. Having served the ancient Buddhas, he had generated the roots of virtue by honouring them and making offerings to them. He had attained patience as well as eloquence. He played with the great super knowledges. He had attained the power of incantations and the fearlessnesses. He had conquered all demons and opponents. He had penetrated the profound way of the Dharma. He was liberated through the transcendence of wisdom. Having integrated his realization with skillful means, he was expert in knowing the thoughts and actions of living beings. Knowing the strength or weakness of their faculties and being gifted with unrivaled eloquence, he taught the Dharma appropriately to each. Having applied himself energetically to the Mahayana, he understood it and accomplished his tasks with great finesse. He lived with the deportment of a Buddha, and his superior intelligence was as wide as an ocean. He was praised, honoured and commended by all the Buddhas, and was respected by Indra, Brahma and all the Lokapalas. In order to develop living beings with his skillful means, he lived in the great city of Vaishali. His wealth was inexhaustible for the purpose of sustaining the poor and the helpless. He observed a pure morality in order to protect the immoral. He maintained patience and self-control in order to reconcile beings who were angry, cruel, violent, and brutal. He blazed with energy in order to inspire people who were lazy. He maintained concentration, mindfulness, and meditation in order to sustain the mentally troubled. He attained decisive wisdom in order to sustain the foolish. He wore the white clothes of the layman, yet lived impeccably like a renunciate. He lived at home, but remained aloof from the realm of desire, the realm of form, and the formless realm. He said he had a son, a wife, and female attendants, yet always maintained celibacy. He appeared to be surrounded by servants, yet lived in solitude. He appeared to be adorned with ornaments, yet always was endowed with the auspicious signs and marks. He seemed to eat and drink, yet always took nourishment from the taste of meditation. He made his appearance at the fields of sports and in the casinos, but his aim was always to mature those people who were attached to games and gambling. He visited the fashionable heterodox teachers, yet always kept unswerving loyalty to the Buddha. He understood the mundane and transcendental sciences and esoteric practices, yet always took pleasure in the delights of the Dharma. He mixed in all crowds, yet was respected as foremost of all. In order to be in harmony with people, he associated with elders, with those of middle age and with the young, yet always spoke in harmony with the Dharma. He engaged in all sorts of businesses, yet had no interest in profit or possessions. To train living beings, he would appear at crossroads and on street corners, and to protect them, he participated in government. To turn people away from the Hinayana and to engage them in the Mahayana, he appeared among listeners and teachers of the Dharma. To develop children, he visited all the schools. To demonstrate the evils of desire, he even entered the brothels. To establish drunkards in correct mindfulness, he entered all the cabarets. He was honoured as the businessman among businessmen because he demonstrated the priority of the Dharma. He was honoured as the landlord among landlords because he renounced the aggressiveness of ownership. He was honoured as the warrior among warriors because he cultivated endurance, determination and fortitude. He was honoured as the aristocrat among aristocrats because he suppressed pride, vanity and arrogance. He was honoured as the official among officials because he regulated the functions of government according to the Dharma. He was honoured as the prince of princes because he reversed their attachment to royal pleasures and sovereign power. He was honoured as the eunuch in the royal harem because he taught the young ladies according to the Dharma. He was compatible with ordinary people because he appreciated the excellence of ordinary merits. He was honoured as the Indra among Indras because he showed them the temporality of their lordship. He was honoured as the Brahma among Brahmas because he showed them the special excellence of Gnosis. He was honoured as the Lokapala among Lokapalas because he fostered the development of all living beings. Thus lived the Lich of Vimalakirti in the great city of Vaishali, endowed with an infinite knowledge of skillful means. At that time, out of this very skillful means, Vimalakirti manifested himself as if sick. To inquire after his health, the king, the officials, the lords, the youths, the aristocrats, the householders, the businessmen, the townsfolk, the country folk, and thousands of other living beings came forth from the great city of Vaishali and called on the invalid. So that's most of chapter 2 of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, where we meet Vimalakirti, whose name means something like stainless glory or pure famed. It's a very, very vivid picture, I think, of this character, this very special character in Buddhist Mahayana literature. Yesterday, we heard about Buddha fields, building Buddha fields, purifying Buddha fields, those environments which are totally conducive to the development of living beings, to the liberation of living beings. And one of the things that we heard about was all these different Buddha fields that the Buddha mentions at one point in the sutra, with all these different ways of connecting, you know, with living beings. I don't know if you remember all those, some of those, or at least some of those different things. And of course, that brings up this whole topic of skillful means. Skillful means being the particular way in which a Buddha or an advanced bodhisattva reaches people where they actually are. And with Vimalakirti, we have the very embodiment of skillful means. Vimalakirti, out of probably in all of the sutras, he is the great embodiment of upaya kaushalya, skillful means. In Thurman's translation, which we'll probably have a reading from tonight, I suspect, he translates it as liberative technique. But just to say, Sangharakshita takes issue with the phrase liberative technique, because it sounds as though, well, technique sounds as though it's, you know, he's doing some sort of trick. Bhante's pointing out that skillful means is something natural, something that comes out of wisdom and is a direct, spontaneous communication from the bodhisattva. The chapter, as I've said, as I read, is called Inconceivable Skillful Means. And I think we need to dwell on that word, inconceivable. Inconceivable, beyond all conceptualization. And I think you can see from the description, and, you know, this is just a portion of Vimalakirti's skillful means. I think it means the vastness of the skillful means, but it also means inconceivable in another sense, achintya. The unthinkable in another sense. Skillful means is the expression of transcendental realization. It's the expression of the Lukutra. It's the expression of that which is beyond the constructed, the conditioned. It's the expression of transcendental wisdom. It's the full expression, upaya kaushala, of the Buddha's wisdom and compassion. In relation to people, to individuals, in their very particular concrete situations. It's very, very important to recall this, to remember this, because the language of skillful means can really cover a multitude of sins, and it can be used as a rationalisation for all kinds of worldly behaviour, for compromise with thoroughly mundane activity. And indeed, sometimes Vimalakirti is invoked to justify thoroughly worldly activity. If you read or listen to Sangharakshita's lecture on this section on skillful means, he even noticed this with the blurb on the different translations of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, where it sort of presents, one of them says something like, this is a very practical text because it shows how a layman can practice Buddhism. And Bhante really takes issue with that, because Vimalakirti only has the appearance of a lay person. And it could, you know, anyway, listen to what Bhante says about that. It's a brilliant sort of analysis of blurb writing, marketing, basically. And yes, sometimes Vimalakirti is invoked to justify all sorts of thoroughly worldly activity. Oh, I go down the pub to drink with people out of skillful means, you know, to bring the drunkards to the Dharma. Really? I thought, isn't it surely it's not just to do with the fact that you like drinking? Or I go clubbing in order to communicate the Dharma to people. Is that really why you go clubbing? Or, you know, I know I get anxious about my work, running the centre, running the business, whatever it is, but it's all skillful means to bring people to Dharma. Really? Is that actually the case? Isn't anxiety a thoroughly unskillful state? So where's the skillfulness in that? I got really angry with this person. I really ripped into them, but that was skillful means. They needed this fierce friendship. Really? Or is this just your thoroughly mundane bad-temperedness? I had sex with this person. They really needed it. It was compassionate, skillful means. I was really spreading the Dharma. Oh, so nothing to do with your desire and your sexual appetite. Yes, I know that we're presenting the Dharma here in a really diluted way, but it's skillful means. Really? Is it really skillful means? I'm slightly exaggerating, but I have heard things very, very close to all these things. The language of Upaya Kaushalya used to invoke the Bodhisattva's compassionate activity. And this isn't just a Western phenomena. In corrupted sort of, you know, sectarian Mahayana traditions, the whole language of skillful means has been used to justify all sorts of thoroughly un-Buddhistic behaviour, including, you know, the war effort in Japan and things like that. There's a very, very important book called Zen at War, which just shows the way in which, you know, terrible atrocities were rationalised in terms of Mahayana Buddhist practice. We should have nothing to do with any of that, and we shouldn't in any way invoke skillful means to justify thoroughly unskillful behaviour. Skillful means is actually a very advanced practice. That's the first thing that we should remember. It's the seventh paramita, the seventh of the perfections that the Bodhisattva follows, coming after prajna paramita, the perfection of transcendental wisdom. So skillful means, in the full sense, is the expression of transcendental wisdom. It's regarded as spontaneous, the spontaneous expression of wisdom and compassion. It's regarded as something very, very subtle, highly effective, completely egoless, and in the five Buddha Mandala, it's particularly associated with Amoghasiddhi. Amoghasiddhi is the, and there he is the particular image for skillful means. Highly effective, very subtle activity that is completely egoless, that leaves no karmic, negative karmic imprint at all. It's thoroughly beneficial. And it's interesting that Amoghasiddhi is sometimes has been called as the sun at midnight. A very, very mysterious figure indeed. It's not sort of overt worldly activity that we engage in. So we need to really reflect on this when we look at this topic of skillful means. It's something to revere, really. It's a, you know, when we hear the description of Vimalakirti, when we, you know, we look at this Upaya Kaushalya Paramita, it's really something we should sort of wonder at. If you like, the magical activity of all the Buddhas. Not think, well, how can I do that now? How can I, you know, how can I do something like that? That's we can't do it at our level, sunk as we are in the swampland of samsara. If we pay close attention to Vimalakirti, the description of Vimalakirti. People immediately see the reference to him hanging out in casinos, going to cabarets, hanging out on street corners, being the businessman, having his female attendants, being the family man, and so on and so forth. Everybody loves all that. They don't pay attention to the other details in the description. He said he had a son and wife, or he appears to have a son and wife and female attendants, but they don't actually show up in the sutra. They don't appear at all in the sutra. It's not that Vimalakirti is sort of playing happy families when everybody comes to see him. It's an appearance. Apparently he's like that, but where are they? He's actually celibate, a celibate renunciate. He says he lives at home, he has a house, he's called the great householder Vimalakirti. But then it says, actually, he's transcended completely the realm of desire, the realm of form, or archetypal form, and the realm of extremely subtle archetypal form. In other words, he's actually dwelling in the Lokuttara. His home is the Lokuttara realm. So it's very, when you actually look through the description, it's very, very paradoxical. He seems to be a man of the world, a man in the world, but he's certainly not of the world in the way that we are of the world. He really is like the proverbial lotus that grows out of the mud of the swamp. He's definitely there in the swamp, but he's not corrupted by the swamp in any way. Remains completely pure and free of the swamp. A bit later on in the sutra, there's an extremely beautiful set of verses that Vimalakirti recites, perhaps even sings, where he talks about, it's called the family of the Tathagatas, because he's asked, who is your mother and father? Who are your sons? Who is your wife? And he says, the bodhisattvas are born of wisdom and skillful means. And he goes on in this way, describing all the categories of the Dharma. It's extremely, you know, beautiful. But the image, nonetheless, is of someone who can connect with anybody. People can relate to them very, very vividly as a person of the world, but, you know, with all the sort of, you know, accoutrements, if you like, that you have when you're in the world. But there's, in other words, this tremendous sort of empathy and presumably approachability. And yet, they're not defined in any way by those things. You know, by any of those things associated with the world. Not restricted by those things in any way. It's a very, very mysterious, inconceivable sort of image that we have with Vimalakirti. And I think it's extremely important, you know, to just dwell on this, to hold this. You know, perhaps you could even go through that description again and again and again and try to feel, you know, what's being communicated with that. And certainly there's sort of antecedents of this with the Buddha himself. There's a passage which I've mentioned a few times in talks, and I've mentioned it a few times because I find it mysterious and intriguing and uplifting. Well, the Buddha is talking to Ananda not long before his passing away and talking about the different assemblies that exist, the different castes and communities, but also different realms of the gods and so on, 7 assemblies in all. And the Buddha says, I've been into every one of those assemblies. And before I went into those assemblies, I adopted the clothing of the beings in those assemblies, and I adopted their language and their voice. And I communicated with them and I spoke to them. And they wondered, who is this person wearing our clothes, speaking our language? We don't know who it is. And then I disappeared from those assemblies. And they said, where has he gone? Where has that person gone? Very, very mysterious. But I think at least it communicates this quality of the Buddha's empathy. The Buddha could speak with anybody, communicate with anybody, but he's not defined by the people in those places, in those realms. So Vimalakirti then is the image, the symbol of a very advanced bodhisattva. Indeed, he appears to almost be like a Buddha. He has the deportment of a Buddha. He is in the world, maturing beings, going into their situation, but he's coming from transcendental reality itself. It's a tremendously inspiring image, I think, for us. But as I've said, the image of an advanced bodhisattva or a Buddha is not something to mimic on our own level. It's rather something to be really lifted up by, inspired by, indeed challenged by. Just a little reflection as well on Vimalakirti's, how does he look? What's his appearance? Because in the sutra, you don't actually get a description of him. We don't know what he was. Well, we know he was wearing the white clothing of a layman, but we don't really know what he looks like. It doesn't say whether he has long hair or a beard or whether he's got a shaved head or anything like that. There's no description, which is rather interesting. There's just a sort of almost a space where Vimalakirti is. And as far as I know, in Indian Buddhist tradition, he was never depicted. And I don't think I've ever seen a depiction of him in Tibetan Buddhism, but in Chinese tradition, you get a lot of paintings and statues of Vimalakirti, and I think in Japanese tradition as well, because the Vimalakirti Nidesha is a very, very important and influential sutra in the East Asian Buddhist traditions. And many of the descriptions of Vimalakirti in Chinese art certainly is of an old man, even a very old man, you know, with long hair and a wispy beard and moustache. A very successful man, a very venerable man, an old wise man kind of image, somebody with enormous experience and depth and ability, highly effective and successful. So maybe you can play with how in your own mind of what Vimalakirti would look like to you. But there's another sense in which perhaps Vimalakirti is not a single person at all, not one man, perhaps. Sangharakshita has said rather mysteriously in various places that as the bodhisattva goes on in their journey of liberating all living beings in their deep Dharma practice, in a sense they cease to be an individual at all. He's spoken of the bodhisattva as a sort of suprapersonal or transpersonal stream of spiritual energy. He says this of Padmasambhava when he did the review of the life and liberation of Padmasambhava, and he said it of different bodhisattvas. Self and other are actually dissolving as you go further and further on, deeper and deeper into the bodhisattva path. Actually, this is what we're invoking at the end of the puja, in that transference of merit and self-surrender, just as the earth and other elements are serviceable in many ways. Well, maybe we should take that quite literally. You know, that we're actually completely giving up any notion of some sort of separate individuality, and we're surrendering ourselves to this sort of force, if you like, of which, yes, transcends self and other entirely, which is just, if you like, the thoroughly egoless work of wisdom and compassion. I know this sounds pretty cosmic, but actually that's what we're really invoking in the puja. We really are invoking, as it were, spiritual death, spiritual rebirth, and spontaneous activity for the benefit of all. Okay, but maybe we've got to, before we get there, we've got to get really down to earth before I get completely, you know, carried away with this. Practically, what can we do without trying to sort of incorporate this transcendence ideal into our own egotism? What can we do practically to, I don't know, have a sort of reflection of this skillful means, paramita, and activity in our life? A reflection, if you like, of Vimalakirti in our behaviour. How can the inspiration turn into something practical? Can we reflect on that? Well, perhaps the easiest way is to turn to not just thinking of ourselves as an individual practicing the Dharma, transforming ourselves, maturing in the Dharma. Yes, we have to do that, of course. But how about thinking of that in terms of, just as importantly, of being in profound harmony and cooperation with others? In other words, really participating fully in Sangha and spiritual community, in an order, even working for the benefit of all, working to bring the Dharma more vividly into the world. And it's interesting when you look at the description of Vimalakirti, the different things that he does. I remember Ratnaguna, you know, in a talk here actually, in talking about Vimalakirti, he said, well, you could think of Vimalakirti as a sort of one-man spiritual community, as it were. You know, all the different things that he does, street corners, Dharma, standing at crossroads, going into all these places. Well, some of those things we actually have going on in our own Sangha. You know, the whole thing of teaching the Dharma, well, that goes on in our centres, goes on in our retreat centres. Vimalakirti goes to schools. Well, I know in lots of centres there are school visits that go on, even schools visiting Buddhist centres, and so on and so forth. Businesses, there's just a few businesses left with the awful thing of the loss of Windhorse trading, although there's still things going on, but businesses and so on. Members of the spiritual community are involved in that. You can even add art centres and all the different things that we do within the order, within the spiritual community. You could see all of that, in a sense, as the activity of a bodhisattva. We're trying to reach different people in all that we do. In fact, there's a strong connection made between the perfection of skillful means and the spiritual community. In the classical description of the perfection of skillful means, Upaya Kaushalya, you get explicit reference to spiritual community. Because the perfection of skillful means consists of the Sangraha Vastus, the Pratisamvids, and the Dharanis. I'm very much following Sangharakshita's lecture, as you can probably guess, on this his lecture on being all things to all men. But I make no apology for that. So the Sangraha Vastus, sometimes translated as the elements of conversion, but they're best translated as the means of unification. And this is explained as the way in which a bodhisattva unites a community of people to help him in his work of building the Buddha land. So this is the way you do it. This is the way you create spiritual community, through the Sangraha Vastus particularly. So it's the way we can unify our spiritual community. It's the way we can reach more and more people as well, in order to bring about the maturing and the emancipation in the end of all living beings. So let's go through these Sangraha Vastus. Some of you, you know, they're probably very familiar to you from your studies, but I think they're well worth, you know, exploring again and again. I still don't think that we've really got to the sort of, you know, bottom of these practices, and of course we need to practice them more and more. So the first of the means of unification is Dharma, generosity. As Sangharakshita says, an old favourite, generosity, giving. Giving, first of all, to one another within the Sangha, within the spiritual community. Expressing our delight at living the Dharma together, whether or not we literally live with people, but living the Dharma together, practicing the Dharma together, coming together with one another, but actually being expressed in deeds, in actions, in things, in gifts. Giving ourselves particularly, but that actually manifesting in the actual things that people need, or the actual things that delight people. It doesn't have to be simply to do with utility. Giving can sometimes have it can be a beautiful thing that just uplifts people, very, very inspires people very, very beautifully. We give to one another because of the special awareness that we have of one another. This is perhaps the key point here. A bodhisattva, it seems, from what I can tell, has a continuous awareness of the sort of living quality in others. And it's that continual awareness of that living quality which is the recognition, the vision, of their potential for Buddhahood, their potential for enlightenment. It's awareness, the bodhisattva has the deepest possible, has awareness of the deepest possible level in others, if you can imagine that. And he is inspired by that. He's delighted by that. You know, if a bodhisattva was to come into this room, he wouldn't see us all as we see each other. He'd be aware of that living, vibrating, spiritual potential, that potential for Buddhahood in us. He would have that delighted awareness of that in us, and he would give to that. He would give us something that would help us to activate that fully. So that's what we need to be developing within the spiritual community itself. Sometimes I think within the Sangha we can get, we can take each other for granted, can't we? We really can. We really don't know what we've got sometimes. And we forget to be generous, you know, with one another. You sort of see it sometimes when people moan and complain about the spiritual community sometimes. You even see it, sadly, you know, within the order. This isn't good enough. That's not good enough. Sangharakshita's teaching isn't good enough. Padmaloka isn't good enough. My centre isn't good enough. My community isn't good enough. And that's because we're not focusing on that special quality that we have within the spiritual community. It's an absolutely amazing thing when people decide to commit themselves to the Dharma. Okay, there's lots of faults, lots of things we can complain about, but the fact that people really want to live a Dharma life really means something. It's very, very rare in this world. So we need to be cultivating, looking much more deeply at one another and developing this delighted awareness of one another and giving to that. And I think if you have that within a spiritual community, you get greater abundance. You're actually recognizing the riches and the richness that's actually present, and that will then flow out. That will flow out beyond the existing spiritual community. That delighted awareness of others will be for everybody, and there'll be this abundant giving, you know, to other people who are coming to the spiritual community, who don't even know yet that they need a spiritual community and they need the Dharma. The description of Vimalakirti is of abundance, isn't it? Abundant generosity, abundant effortless activity, pouring out of that transcendental wisdom, pouring out of his love of the Buddha, his love of the Dharma, his love of the Sangha. It's just flowing forth. Well, we need that. We need to work at cultivating that. You know, the vibe we should be, we should be putting out is of pleasure. You know, in our work for the Dharma, in our Dharma life, not thinking, oh, what a drag this is. You know, another class. You know, another talk. And what, I'm going on retreat again, another going for refuge. What a drag the ordination process is, you know, etc., etc. Well, I mean, don't be surprised if you don't get anywhere with that attitude. You know, don't be surprised if you don't make any progress. You've really got to look freshly at yourself, freshly at other people. You know, look at those the Buddhist traditions, I mean, that emphasise the recognition of the preciousness of human existence itself. Get that very, very strongly. The first of the, you know, the mind turnings that turn you towards the Dharma. Just the sheer preciousness of living, of being alive. Well, not only are we alive, we have the Dharma. We have the possibility of maturing in the Dharma. If we could see this, there would flow forth much, much greater generosity. We'd give ourselves much, much fully to our Dharma life, to others in the Sangha, to those who want the Sangha, want the Dharma. So that's the first thing, generosity. the famous saying of Sangharakshita years and years ago in the early days of the movement, when people really weren't that generous and quite mean-spirited, really. He really thought that the Dharma bowl at the Buddhist centre was really the spiritual barometer of the centre. That was the spiritual barometer. That really told you whether or not people were making progress. Interesting thought. The second of the Sangharavastus is Priyavadita. Priyavadita, loving speech, affectionate speech. The Bodhisattva expresses his love for others, not just in generous deeds, but he doesn't mind telling people how much he loves them, how much he loves that, you know, he gives full expression in voice, in communication, to his delighted awareness at the living beingness of living beings and of the potential that he sees in them. He really doesn't mind telling them how much he loves them, how much he appreciates them. He doesn't mind telling them their qualities, doesn't mind telling them their faults on occasion as well, but only out of that love and care for their spiritual development, that maturing. Vimalakirti certainly doesn't mind telling people their faults and showing them their limitations. He's like a thunderbolt sometimes, but it's entirely coming out of his expression, his response of compassion for their welfare. Well, in the Sangha we need to express that. Remember, the Sangharavastus are the means of unification. We need to tell people that we love them. You know, assuming that we do love them. We need to really look for their qualities and rejoice in their qualities. If you don't love people in the Sangha, it probably means that you're not doing enough metta-bhavana for people in the Sangha. It probably means you're not reflecting on their qualities enough. This is something that the Buddha emphasises again and yet again in the Pali Canon, how within the Sangha itself, among his disciples, there must be constant expression of delight for one another. He talks about developing the Priya Chakshu, the eye of love, the eye of affection. And the word for Priya is a very, very strong word for love. It's in a sense even stronger than metta. It's this very strong affection and love for others. So yes, the Bodhisattva is completely unafraid of expressing his love. I mean, be a bit careful, you know, at a beginner's class, and going up to somebody and telling them how much you love them. It might freak them out. You know, do remember skillful means. You might have to just tone it down a little. Yes, but it should not just be within the Sangha itself, but it should flow over as well, you know, to those who are coming to the Sangha. And, you know, and this is just expressed in straightforward friendliness. You know, and it is great to hear, you know, people say again and again, the thing that really, you know, brought them to the centre that they really liked was the friendliness and the courtesy, you know, and the warmth of the people, you know, running the classes and the retreats and so on and so forth. I think that's a really wonderful gift. Yes, but in the Sangha too, you know, don't just sort of assume that people know how you feel about them. You know, again, sometimes people can wonder, you know, how they're getting on in their Dharma life, because nobody tells them that they're doing well. Nobody tells them how much they're appreciated. Somebody in our group was saying yesterday that in a conversation with an order member, this order member just said, you know, they're a bit concerned about entering the ordination process and so on. At the end of it, I think he said, this order member said something like, "I think you'll do well with it." Just simple words. "I think you'll be all right. I think you'll do well." And he said it gave him so much confidence. You know, so that's such a gift. And that's loving speech, kindly speech. And I know the order member concerned. He wouldn't just say that as a token, as a nice thing to say. He's saying that because he's aware of that person and aware of the ordination process. Well, we need to do that for one another. Really express our appreciation for one another. And yes, with everybody that we meet. Yesterday we had in our group a bit of a sort of discussion about within the Sangha, outside the Sangha, those who are interested in Buddhism, those who are not. Of course, a bodhisattva isn't really thinking like that. They just communicate with whoever they meet. They get into rapport with anybody. And their loving speech and their generosity is for anybody. Although having said that, of course, they need to focus. They need to focus particularly on those people who are really up for the Dharma. Because they want their Dharma work to go on way, way into the future. So we need to remember that too. The third of the Sangharavastus, the means of unification, is Artacharya, which can be translated as doing good, which sounds awful, or meaningful activity, beneficial activity. And it's explained in the commentaries in particular as communicating the Dharma in its fullness, appropriately, skillfully. The greatest good you can do is to communicate the Dharma in all that you do, in all your activity. And especially when you get the chance of communicating the Dharma in its fullness to people as the means to liberation. We're not talking about sectarian Buddhism or something like that. We're talking about really seeing that the Dharma brings about the liberation of living beings. This is not a luxury item. The Dharma, giving the Dharma, is not a luxury item. You know, we're not talking about something that you can sort of take or leave. Sometimes I think people, you know, sort of think, you know, you sometimes get questions about this in terms of compassionate activity. Why don't you do more social work? Why don't you do more this, that, the other? More environmentalism, feeding the hungry, housing the homeless, and so on. Well, it would be good to do those things. But how many people are actually really communicating the Dharma in this world? And do we really know what the Dharma does to people? You know, it's called the end of suffering, the liberation from all suffering. So I think sometimes our doubt about communicating the Dharma in the fullness is because we don't know what this Dharma is. So we think of it as a sort of luxury item. It's the very essence of life. You know, that's what we're addressing when we communicate the Dharma to people. And of course, it's not forcing the Dharma on people. As I say, it should perfume and pervade all your communication somewhere. And when it's appropriate, you'll tell people about the Dharma. But of course, as well, you will set up situations where people can hear the Dharma, as I say, in its fullness. You know, from real depth. You know, this I think again is something very, very important in centres, in groups and branches. You know, I know sometimes people feel we've got to sort of reach people where they're at. So people suffer from stress and this, that and the other. So let's teach relaxation at our centre and all these different applications of the Dharma. It's a good thing. Let's alleviate that suffering. But there has to be, in a Buddhist centre, if it really is a Buddhist centre, the possibility of connecting with that transcendental dimension. And that must be alive in the people teaching there, living there, practicing there. It must be visible even from the very beginning. It's something that I'm the president of the Buddhist centre that we have in Sheffield. And it's very, very strong. Their message is very clear. They don't do meditation courses. They call them Buddhism and meditation courses. And the first night, people get taught the lakshanas in a very, very positive way, I should add, a very, very, you know, positive way of teaching the lakshanas. But they're insistent, we're not just a meditation centre. They do drop-in classes as well. We are a Buddhist. We teach the Dharma. That's the primary element in this place. And their courses are packed, 80 people, maybe moving down to about 60. People want the Dharma. And if you're confident in the Dharma, and you have a place that's really buzzing with the Dharma, people will really connect with it. And you're alive with it. One of the things that Sangharakshita says at this point, that when what you're trying to communicate when you communicate the Dharma, it's not just the doctrines, and it's not, certainly not, you know, techniques, so that you will teach the methods. It's the sheer adventure of Dharma life. the sheer adventure. That's what you're doing. You're sparking off people to go on the great adventure. I mean, sometimes people ask me, how was it that you got involved with the Dharma when you were 17? And that's my answer sometimes. Adventure. Adventure. You know, a young man, you know, 17, and you're showed this incredible magic and possibility. Well, that's going to make you want to leave home and give up everything. The sheer adventure, the quest, if you like. Well, people do want, there are people who want that adventure. They're starving for the lack of adventure. You know, they're bored of, you know, going on holidays to India or Southeast Asia, wherever it is. Everybody's done that. You know, that's a cliche. You know, what about this? The adventure of consciousness, the adventure of Dharma. That's what we've got to show people. Of course, you've got to be living it yourself. If really be in that adventure yourself. Then the fourth of the Sangravastus is Samanatata, exemplification. And we've got Samanata here, the very embodiment of exemplification. No pressure, Samanata.
Thank you.
Practicing what you preach, Padmavajra. Practicing what you preach. Harmonizing the teaching and your life. Harmonizing your understanding and your life by bringing your life up to your understanding, transforming your life in the light of the vision, in the light of the ideal. I was reading a very, very strong teaching by a Tibetan yogi the other day where he was really having a go at people going on about doing the highest practice, the highest perfection, the great perfection, Dzogchen, Mahamudra, insight, wisdom, shunyata. And he was really scathing and talking about the fact, well, they're just like soup with great big lumps of vegetable in it that hasn't dissolved into the mix. So that's what we're like. We're really sort of lumpy. We've got all these ideas about the Dharma, all these sort of big ideas of where we are, but actually it's all really lumpy, you know, and bumpy and undigested. We've actually got to harmonise and blend, you know, our life with the Dharma, be transformed by the Dharma. Great image, very, you know, down-home image. So we need to exemplify the Dharma life. And it's tremendously attractive when you see it. When you see somebody living it. They're not just talking it. Maybe they don't even talk it very much, but they're living it. You know, they're consistently kind, consistently generous, consistently mindful in everything they do. That's very inspiring and moving. You know, always, you know, turning their mind to meditation, to study, to reflection, you know, to service for others. It's wonderful, you know, when you see that. That makes you want to live the life of adventure. So we need to exemplify. But does it mean we can't do this? You know, because it almost sounds as though to practice this, you've got to be an advanced bodhisattva. Well, Sangharakshita says, no, of course, we're not like this. You know, we have our good times and we have our not so good times. You know, there's a gap between, you know, our ideal and vision of life and our actual practice. And it's very important to be honest about that and to be really clear about where we are. We might be very inspired. You know, on a good day, that inspiration is being expressed in our body, speech and mind, but it's not always like that. But what we can exemplify is effort for people. We can exemplify the life of making effort. And yes, we can share our inspirations, our successes, but we can also be honest about our failings. And that can be very inspiring for people as well. People, you know, really get moved by that. And in fact, that can be, in some ways, more inspiring than meeting a very advanced bodhisattva, because, you know, you can relate to the person who's sort of struggling and working on themselves. So we exemplify, in other words, a process. A creative process. That's what we exemplify. And in fact, you know, in a sense, that process never ever comes to an end. So it's not a question of exemplifying some sort of stage, some sort of irreversibility or something like that. That's not what you exemplify. You exemplify this continuous process of maturing and transforming. You exemplify the quest, the adventure of the Dharma life to others. Perhaps as well you exemplify, perhaps the thing that is most wonderful, that can really inspire people, is friendships. People seeing the fact that people genuinely love one another, you know, and love working together for the Dharma. I used to feel this quite strongly in India, you know, when we used to do all these Dharma talks in Bombay, which is a very, very rough city. And we used to give Dharma talks in rough parts of town. And our little spiritual community, me and the order members and Mitras, we'd go out to these places and we were very much a team. And of course, I'd give the talk, Bodhi Sen would translate, somebody else would lead the refuges and precepts, somebody else would do the introduction, we'd all have our blue shirts on, and you know, and so on and so forth. And I thought to myself, what's really making the impact here is not me, it's us. That's, and the fact that we just really loved it, gassed on it, you know, really enjoyed what we were doing. And that's what brought people to the Dharma. And people still talk about those times, you know, in India, the people that came along. So, yes, exemplifying that to people. So time is running on. And do you mind a bit later lunch? So I would like to just do the last bit briefly, the pratisambit. Sorry about this, that you have to put up with my words. But let's do the last of the skillful means. So these are the pratisambits, the analytical knowledges, which Sangharakshita says isn't really a good translation. So there are four of these. There's Dharma Pratisamvit. So this is the direct, non-dual, wordless realization of reality of an advanced bodhisattva, of the truth. Wow. Not sure how we can practice this, but anyway, I'm just the messenger. Though interestingly enough, Sangharakshita said traditionally in the Dasabhumika Sutra, very important Mahayana Sutra, this Dharma Pratisamvada is said to be particularly the realization, the direct wordless realization of the Ekayana, of the one way, the Buddha Yana, seeing the way in which all yanas, all ways, all ways of practicing the Dharma emerge in the end into the one way towards Buddhahood. In other words, it's a direct realization of what Sangharakshita has called the transcendental principle of the Dharma. The spirit, if you like, that informs all expressions of the Dharma. The transcendental spirit, if you like. And this is, I think, it might seem very, very advanced and so on, but we need to try and develop at least some sort of feeling for what this might be. You know, I know sometimes people feel, you know, in our Tri Ratna, well, there's just so much stuff. It's all these words, all these teachings, you know, different practices. What on earth? What do I practice? What do I do? Can't it just be simple? You know, just one teaching, one thing that you just believe and follow and everything would be all right. That's Christianity, actually. It's not really like that, actually. And the Dharma, I don't think, is actually like that. And it's even seemed to have been a problem in the Buddha's day for people. What you have to do is to really try to see, intuit, the living spirit of the Dharma in all the different practices and teachings you encounter. They're all actually pointing, I'm going to say the same thing or one thing, but it's not one in the numerical sense. But that's what we have to be intuitive. In the end, it's all about what leads to emancipation, what leads to liberation, the taste of freedom, the mutti rasa. That's what we need to be getting from all these different teachings and practices. Then there's artha pratisamvid, analytical knowledge of meaning. That transcendental Dharma is expressed in concepts, in principles, conditioned co-production, the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. So as well as having that sense of the spirit of the Dharma, we also need to be familiar with the language of the Dharma. We need to be familiar with the classical central teachings of the Dharma that the Buddha has transmitted and that has come down to us. We need, in other words, to develop, make sure that we have a common language. And by a common language, I don't mean a jargon. I mean really understanding what these teachings are saying, both in the letter and the spirit. We really need to go into that much, much more deeply than we do. Study it, reflect on it, realise it. It's interesting as well, this common, talking about common language, talking about the Ekayana, talking about seeing that where the Dharma sort of leads. Sangharakshita has a very, very deep feeling for an understanding of what he calls the transcendental unity of Buddhism. Realised that very, very early on. I think his first essay that he wrote when he was 17 was on the unity of Buddhism. Amazing. And in the Survey of Buddhism, that comes out very, very strongly. And that goes on more and more practically. He's got enormous faith that the Dharma is really pointing to liberation. And he's also tried to work that out, or see that, not work it out, but see it practically. His identification with going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha as the central and defining act of a Buddhist life. And even sort of connecting that, even saying that the other sort of transitional moments, like the arising of the bodhicitta, stream entry, irreversibility, and so on and so forth, are all describing, you know, they're different ways of describing one experience. Really very, you know, that needs a lot of reflection. But you can see what he's trying to do. He's trying to show us practically how we can realise that unity, if you like, the unity of the Dharma. If you read the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, he tries to see the ten precepts as what he calls the Mula Pratimoksha, the fundamental ethical code that underlies all Buddhist ethical codes. And his arguments are very, very cogent. He's trying to see that deep unity and to realise that in our experience. Yes. Then there's Nirukti. Nirukti Pratisamvid, analytical knowledge of etymology. It's not just a question of the concepts and the ideas, it's the very words that express those ideas. Words are actually very important. This is paradoxical, I know, when we talk about a tradition that goes beyond language, but language is so important. A great bodhisattva is someone who knows the exact words to use to express the concepts that express the transcendental meaning. The right words, the right metaphors, the right similes, you know, to really touch people, to get through to people, you know, to delineate, you know, this and not that, to show people the right way. And then there's Pratibhana Pratisamvid, analytical knowledge of courage, which is also explained as ready speech, wit. Really, so it's really tuned up communication, the right words at the right time, said in the right way to the people you're talking to, the person you're talking to, which express not just exact words, but they're appropriate and tuned in, which express the concepts, which express the transcendental reality. This is the skillful means of the bodhisattva, really, really tuned up. Amazing. What a tradition we've got here. What an adventure to kind of learn how to live this kind of life. And I must say, I have to say, that for me, Sangharakshita is a living example of that. I never forget seeing him in India, when he returned to India, when we were first there. The way he tuned into people, the way he talked, you know, really, you know, really in tune with the aspirations of Dalit Buddhists, knowing exactly where they, their background, knowing exactly how to connect them with the Dharma. And, you know, a lot of these people, you know, very uneducated, even illiterate, but not afraid, for example, in the beginning of one talk, to just roll out the Yogacara system of consciousness. Everybody completely gripped. And when he got to talking about the Krishto-mano-vijnana, the defiled mind consciousness, the mind that creates duality, saying, this is where caste comes from. You know, really bringing it home to the people, at which there was this applause, like the Olympic Games, you know, every so often Sangha actually getting a medal for a particularly brilliant piece of oratory. But really tuned into people, and not just on the big platform, but people individually. I saw him talking to one of the first Dharmacharini in India, Dharmalochana, who was a very old disciple of Sangharakshita. And I saw him talking in Hindi to her, telling her about her personal meditation practice, and completely tuned in to her concerns, her practice, what she needed to do, and the quality of attention, you know, to her. Sangharakshita points out that with these pratisandhids, Manjugosha, who we have on the shrine, is particularly invoked, you know, to develop the pratisandhids, this awareness of that which is beyond all language, the Lakutra, enlightenment itself, the inconceivable, that which is the concepts with which that's expressed, the words with which the concepts are expressed, and the actual moment of communication. Manjugosha is the great embodiment of that. So if you want some divine aid with that, invoke Manjugosha. And there's a last element of skillful means, it's said, that the Bodhisattva has when he's developing this paramita. These are called the Dharanis. Dharanis are sort of magical formulae that are actually given to bodhisattvas by devas. Devas are very attracted to bodhisattvas and they want to protect them, they want to look out for them. So they'll give them a special invocation which they can say to protect them from, you know, people who want to undermine their work. But Sangharakshita decides to interpret it in a rather different way in his lecture, which I think is really important. He says what the Dharanis perhaps really represent for a bodhisattva's skillful means is that touch of the inconceivable, the magical, that which is beyond all language, all ideas, that extra special magic, something that you really can't pin down, you can't get hold of, that it completely eludes you. That quality that Vimalakirti has, that thing you think you've got the bodhisattva, no, you haven't got them. You just can't contain them. And somehow that's coming across, that's communicating to you, and you just want to be part of that magic, that life.